This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 15th of September 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to episode 219 of the Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck.
On the show today, we'll be talking photography, science, and perhaps trying to combine the two with Greg Hobson, curator of the very first exhibition about to go and show at the new Media Space Gallery at London's Science Museum.
And later we'll be learning how much is enough with economics and philosophy specialists Robert and Edward Skidelsky. Let's just hope the father and son team haven't had enough of each other.
And we'll be hearing from Marcus Imhoff, the Swiss filmmaker whose new film, More Than Honey, documents the global decline in the number of bees and asks, how can it be stopped? He'll be telling us later.
That's all coming up in the next hour. Plus, we'll get a German-themed news look ahead from Tom Edwards in Frankfurt and enjoy some great tunes too right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Man alive, here we are again, Andrew. Back in our positions, in our rightful places, possibly.
Yes.
Maybe not, who knows.
Yeah. And we've had a little bit of a trip this week together.
We have. We toddled off to Amsterdam, didn't we?
Yes.
First of all, we had a book launch for the Monocle Guide to Better Living in London. Bit of a warm-up lap.
Yeah, that was on Tuesday.
That was a successful evening. I think Wednesday might have been more successful.
Yes. I think we reached new heights. We were very good with Team De Nederland. They were amazing supporters. So we had a party which was at Hotel V in Amsterdam, amazingly hosted also by the American book company. And they were just great. They kind of really kind of put on a great show. And we sold tons of books.
It was a really successful evening, wasn't it? It had a good vibe, I think, there. They're sort of very strong gin and tonics. I forget who the man was who was the sort of distiller, some sort of small Dutch distillery.
Yes,
he provided the grog, and all we had to do was sign people's books.
And what you and me found was
there's some sort of subtext here which I'm not understanding.
But we also discovered that it's quite scary signing a book, because when you've got somebody who's bought an expensive book and you go to write their name and it's a Dutch name and you're not very good at spelling, it's a bit worrying you're going to throw the kind of... And also, there was a couple of occasions when I said to somebody, how do you spell your name? They said, well, it's Julia, it's G-U-L. Really a G? Oh, no, I mean a J.
Yeah.
You could have destroyed a book by that point.
I know, exactly. I didn't manage to sort of dirty anyone's copy. I don't think I kind of... I don't want to rip a page out. I think it was all right. That was a good little party, though. It's a nice place to have a thing. And yes. Lots of people came up to me and said, you don't do enough Amsterdam. We love you guys here. And we were like, I think you do. I think we're going to come back.
I missed you on the flight back, though.
Sort of, I snuck in right at the end of the day, of the next day. Anyway.
But that is another story for another day.
That's absolutely, I think when everyone's really sitting comfortably, then we'll begin that one. Okay. But first of all, we've got a German-themed news look ahead.
With Herr Edwards.
With Herr Edwards. So without further ado, let's see if they've updated his catchphrase.
Herr Tom Edwards. Und jetzt werfen wir einen Blick auf die kommende Woche. Bitte vergrüßen Sie Herr Tom Edwards.
Oh my God, that's quite amazing.
I didn't even know I was joking.
I was joking, though. I had no idea that he had actually updated his jingle. I quite like that. I think we should definitely play that again after we've spoken to Herr Edwards. What a sexy voice that German robot had.
Yes, a bit of kind of Kraftwerk-y.
Very Kraftwerk.
So Kraftwerk. It was good.
I can hear Tom. Tom likes it. Tom, how's it going in Frankfurt?
Guten Tag, Rob and Andrew. Guten Tag indeed. Yeah, very good. I should just paint you a quick picture. I'm sitting on a beautiful cobbled street here in Alt-Sachsenhausen, the old town, and I'm enjoying a well-earned Stein of Fine Pilsner.
Is it sunny there then?
It's a beautiful day. Yeah, the sun is shining. A kind of a early lunch. I've already made my way through something called Der Bunter, which was a kind of a flatbread laden with chilies and so forth, and I'm awaiting a large steak.
So you've actually proved this week you can combine drinking and driving then, because you've been there at the motor show, haven't you?
Yeah, not a combination I recommend to anyone in terms of legally, Andrew, you understand. But yeah, I was here at the IAA motor show last week with the rest of the gang, and it was a pretty impressive and very large-scale occasion. I thought I'd stick around and enjoy Frankfurt for a couple of days, see what the city had to offer.
Secretly, you're a bit of a petrol head, aren't you?
That's right. It takes me back to my youth. When I was a young boy, Andrew, I used to put pictures of my favourite cars up on the walls and dream about one day racing around in a Ferrari or a Lamborghini, something like that.
Does it literally make you get excited when you see a nice car?
No.
I think there's a name for that.
It sounds like a J.G. Ballard novel waiting to happen.
Absolutely. Now, I'm sure you fellows would like to know exactly what is coming up this week. Moving swiftly on. And I thought what I'd do is maybe bring you a bit of a, something of a German theme this week. How do you feel about that?
Go for it. Das ist sehr gut.
Das ist sehr gut. Ziemlich gut, ja. Now, of course, it's the important thing to bear in mind, Andrew and Rob, is that it's the federal elections next weekend. Naturally, that is dominating the agenda here. And I should point out, in fact, that I was fortunate enough to actually bump into none other than Frau Angela Merkel herself at the IAA motor event on Thursday.
She's sitting on a bonnet.
She was a high-end hood ornament. No, it was very funny. And what struck me, I must say, when I saw her in the flesh, she is quite a diminutive lady. And I was actually relating the story to one of our cab drivers, and I explained, oh, she's very small. And he said to me very seriously, yes, but so was Napoleon.
Wow. And is that kind of the analogy that you'd normally found made between those two characters in Germany? I thought everyone loved Frau Angela.
Well, that's it. It's not looking maybe that good for her, though, Rob, when it comes to the actual election. It's widely tipped. Obviously, she'll need to remain in some kind of coalition. It's looking unlikely that her CDU-CSU party will be able to form a coalition with the FDP, so it remains to be seen. It could be good news for Per Steinbrück. More likely, the SPD candidate, of course, more likely perhaps to be victorious.
And just quickly tell me, often when you're in Germany around election times, I'm always struck by just the huge amount of posters that go up, and they're very kind of, you know, they're of a type. They're always kind of like nice pictures of, you know, happy politicians smiling down at you. Is it a kind of big media blitz there at the moment?
It's huge, Andrew, and it is exactly how you characterise it. There's pictures of a sort of very friendly-looking Frau Merkel smiling down. One interesting poster in particular that we've mentioned before in Monocle 24 is one of just her hands. She often holds her hands in a certain way on her public appearances, and they've zeroed right in on that, I think, to sort of show that she's perhaps a woman of substance and a woman that the German public can trust. Will they be convinced? We'll have to wait and see.
And what's your next story?
Well, one other quick one I just thought I'd mention. Later today, there's the Summer Break Festival is taking place right here in Frankfurt. You can probably already hear some of the excited revellers behind me. A music festival today.
That sounds oddly like Marcus Hippie in the background.
Oh, I couldn't possibly be drawn on that, Andrew, of course. But lots of German pop favourites, many that will be familiar to regular listeners to the our Continental Shift and Atlantic Shift on Monocle 24, Fritz Kalkbrenner, Paul Kalkbrenner, Michael Meyer, so many more, all performing here in Frankfurt. So if anyone else is passing through the city, they should stop by.
Sounds great. Earbuds will be available, presumably.
And is that all the news you've drummed up this week?
Well, no, I've got one more German theme one for you very briefly. Next weekend, let's look ahead to Saturday. You know what starts on Saturday? Oktoberfest.
Oh, of course.
Perhaps the world's greatest celebration of booze and bombast kicks off, of course, in Munich, in Bavaria, a little south from here. The world's largest fair. More than 5 million people will be there. It's happened every year since 1810. Many imitators all around the world try and do their own version. No one really measures up to our Bavarian friends. So definitely one to pick out if you're in or around Munich from next weekend onwards.
So will you be easing on your Lederhosen?
Well, I will be. I won't be attending the Oktoberfest. I'll just be rocking the Lederhosen just for a laugh.
Tom, just finally, what was the fancy car you had on your bedroom wall when you were a kid? What was your Athena poster of choice?
Well, I used to go for actually old school favourites, Rob. So I used to have a classic Jaguar, the XK150, if you will.
Nice, very nice, yeah. I was a Lamborghini Countach man. That'll come as no surprise to you.
Yeah, a celebration of all that was great about the 80s. I don't know if that says more about the car or more about you, Rob.
Well, on that note, Tom Edwards, we're going to thank you very much for your check-in. Enjoy the rest of your Stein and many more to come. And we're going to leave it there. But I want to listen to Tom's wonderful Kraftwerkian sign-off. Thanks, Tom.
Herr Tom Edwards. Und jetzt werfen wir einen Blick auf die kommende Woche. Bitte vergrüßen Sie Herr Tom Edwards.
Thanks, Tom. You are tuned in to the Monocle Weekly. We'll be speaking to photography curator Greg Hobson after this.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Buenos Aires
to Hong Kong
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Toronto
to Amsterdam
to Zurich.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
And you are back with The Weekly. The worlds of science and art don't always sit comfortably. One, the doggedly logical pursuit of human advancement. The other, an indulgence of creative whims. And just because.
But don't tell the Science Museum that. The London Institution will be opening its brand new gallery this September, the Media Space. The £4 million, 500 square metre gallery will host major exhibitions of art and photography, plus installations and creative workshops, and is a collaborative venture between the Science Museum and the National Media Museum in Bradford, home of the National Photography Collection.
The first event taking place at the Media Space is only in England, photographs by Tony Ray Jones and Martin Parr. And we're lucky to be joined by the exhibition's curator, Greg Hobson, from the National Media Museum. Greg, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. And now the National Media Museum and the Science Museum join forces. They walk down the aisle hand in hand. When was the idea of a photography show first put together for this first show?
Well, we've been planning Media Space for some time, and the idea of showing Tony Ray Jones and Martin Parr was formulated probably about a year ago. However, ever since acquiring the Tony Ray Jones archive back in 1993, we have wanted to find a way of accessing the material in that archive in a new and interesting way. So knowing how much Martin Parr has been influenced by Tony Ray Jones, I have been thinking about that relationship for a very long time in terms of an exhibition.
So this is kind of something you've always sort of had up your sleeve, wanted to do, and wanted to make the connection between those two photographers, the work of which I guess will be familiar to a lot of English eyes at least, and that's the subject of the show, right?
Yeah, it's material which I think a lot of people, particularly in London, won't be familiar with. And Martin has always said that Tony Ray Jones is one of the photographers who has been most influential on him, and that's not only on his early work. He still looks at Tony Ray Jones now and thinks about what Tony Ray Jones is trying to achieve in his pictures with his very current work. And what I wanted to do really was demonstrate the link between the two, and in particular, their very particular way of looking at the English. Tony Ray Jones spent 4 years between 66 and 69 concentrating on a project all about the English, and in particular English eccentricities. And Martin was introduced to this work. He never actually met Tony Ray Jones, but he was introduced to the work as a young student in Manchester, and moved after graduating to a place called Hebden Bridge, which is in the Cold Valley in West Yorkshire, and began a project there in black and white. Most of us think about colour photography when we think about Martin Parr, photographing the communities that were largely organised around these small chapels, small Methodist chapels, called the Nonconformist Chapels, which is why the project's called the Nonconformists. And it's very plain to see the relationship between the two photographers, their spatial awareness, their interest in the very little, almost invisible to our observing eyes, human quirks that make a very powerful and very interesting photograph.
And Greg, what can you tell us, especially about Tony Ray Jones? Tragically, he died when he was only 30 years old. What was his story? How did he become, you know, such a great photographer in such a short amount of time?
He was a very, very driven individual. We have, along with the photographs and negatives, his notebooks and writings, his musings, if you like. And through those, we can tell exactly how driven he was. He had quite an unusual upbringing. His father died when he was still a baby, before he was 1 year old. He went to Christ Hospital School, which he actually absolutely hated. It's a very unpleasant experience for him. And then he, at a very early age, decided that he was interested in the arts and in graphic design initially, and went to the London College of Printing. And he was taught by someone called Rolf Brandt at the college. And Rolf was Bill Brandt's brother, very well-known British photographer. And he introduced him to European photographers. And Tony was very inspired by this work, and started to think that he might want to be a photographer himself. And he was sufficiently driven and sufficiently ambitious to get a bursary to go to Yale in New York State, to study graphic design, but made the decision when arriving in New York that he wanted to be a photographer, and so immersed himself completely and utterly in the photography scene of the time.
What's interesting, I guess, what was happening at that time in the world of film and in literature and in art, you know, that there was a drawback to reality about real lives and, you know, what we call the kitchen sink dramas. Is he kind of born out of that world a little bit?
He is. He's very much born out of that world. I think one of the things that's difficult for us to imagine now that pretty much everybody who has a mobile phone has a camera is exactly what a blank canvas it was for photographers at the time. They were really inventing a new way of thinking about photography and photography's possibilities. And there was a book published in America by a photographer called Robert Frank. It was published initially in 1958. It was a very slow burner, the book. It wasn't necessarily something that exploded onto the scene, but it ended up being really, really influential on this new group of photographers. And what it allowed them to do was essentially what they wanted, to express themselves creatively however they wanted. And this was a new language for photography and one that Tony Ray Jones completely embraced. And he learned his style on the streets of America, traveling around to parades and parks and so on. And that's the style that he brought back to Britain, where he started to photograph in black and white.
Greg, this show is obviously on in part of the new wing of the Science Museum. It's an entirely curatorial, sort of artistic show. Look at the similarities between these two photographers. Or is there an idea of the process and some of the sort of technical elements in how they worked as well?
We're not necessarily looking at the technical elements, but what we are doing with Tony Ray Jones in particular is looking at his methods. So we have a number of cases in the show where you can see his thinking. So his notebooks will be on display. We'll also be showing some of his test prints, so you can see what he was seeking to achieve in the final print.
I guess, Greg, what we're trying to hint at is, could you just explain to listeners what the link is in the way between the media collection and the Science Museum? How did the Science Museum end up being host to this?
Well, our collection, the National Media Museum in Bradford, is part of the Science Museum, and our collection, our photography collection, originated in the Science Museum. And that is actually what makes it quite unique, where many institutions around the world that collect photography, they will tend to concentrate on usually quite small numbers of exemplary versions of photographs by practitioners, and practitioners that are considered to be fine artists rather than simply photographers. Our collection, because it originates in the Science Museum, consists of large archives, complete bodies of work by photographers, including negatives and, as I say, notebooks and so on that give contextual background. And we felt that there are some 3 million photographs and associated photography objects in the collection in Bradford, and we felt it was important that these had really a stage in London where people could see what we had and see the long relationship that the Science Museum Group has had with photography.
And as an opening show for this new part of the Science Museum, is photography always a bit of a dead cert for the public, Greg? I mean, obviously the numbers of photographs bought as art objects to hang over the fireplace are more than paintings. I guess it's a good commercial decision possibly as well, right?
Well, I think so, but as a photography curator, I would obviously say that.
Greg, can I also ask you, I understand your need to make these exhibitions feel fresh and to, you know, make new links and to add a contemporary edge in a way. Do you think that's sad in a way, though? Because, you know, when I looked through the images that you've got for Tony, that they're so extraordinary. I kind of felt that, you know, I would have been happy just seeing an exhibition almost solely of his work. But do you feel it's important for you as a curator to somehow give it a contemporary edge as well? Otherwise, people just won't come and see it.
Not really, and it's very nice of you to say that. I think Tony Ray Jones' work is incredibly powerful and feels as fresh today as it did when he was making it. And I think it's a tragedy that he's not more widely known, and hopefully this show is going to address that. But what I wanted to do as a curator was show how the spirit of Tony Ray Jones is still alive, and that even though he died very young, that his baton was essentially picked up by Martin Parr, and that Martin Parr is still running with it. And it was very interesting to hear Martin say, after having looked through some 2,700 contact sheets to make a selection of unseen works for this exhibition, that it's inspired him to go back out in Britain to take photographs at the seaside and at events in the UK, which I think is really lovely. And for me, that should be celebrated as part of this show.
As our first ever book, The Monocle Guide to Better Living, begins hitting shelves around the world, so too do our editors take to the road to celebrate the launch of this 408-page survey on how to live well. We're visiting our favourite bookstores and retailers in 15 cities across the globe to meet subscribers, contributors and fans. Join us for a glass of wine, a spot of shopping and a chance to meet the team. To find out where we're headed in September and October, keep an eye on book.monocle.com.
The Review is Monocle 24's weekly review and preview of the arts. Every Saturday, we take a relaxed look back at the books, TV shows, films, music, theatre and events that have made our week, while looking around the corner to scout out the next big thing.
It doesn't feel sappy, it doesn't feel sentimental. It does have a certain heft.
It's very Darwinian. The shows that do well run and the ones that don't close. And there have been some quite high-profile flops and some great successes as well.
For me, it's riotous, it's tasteless, but it's actually dynamic as well. It has momentum.
Join Monocle's editors as they sit down with our favourite critics, opinion makers and key industry figures for some in-depth discussion and lively debate. And we provide inspiration for the weekend from cities around the world.
It's a real divider because I know some people just love this film and other people really just hate it.
That's A Review, every Saturday at midday London time and across the weekend, right here on Monocle 24.
Time for some music now. This is brand new from Connecticut's finest funk revivalist, the Step Kids, with Moving Pictures. That was Moving Pictures by the Step Kids from their new album Troubadour, and we're going to be learning how much is enough after this. With the global economy now showing signs of recovery, however slight, after a downturn that's dominated headlines since 2007, there may be a few budding entrepreneurs setting their sights on living the good life.
But can you have too much of a good thing? The age-old question of how much is enough is the title of a new book from Robert and Edward Skidelsky. Unusually, the book's authors are father and son, Robert, the economic historian, and Edward, a specialist in political philosophy. Monocle's Steve Bloomfield met them a little earlier to find out more.
Robert and Edward, thank you very much for coming to join us on the Monocle Weekly. Your book is called How Much Is Enough? There's an obvious question to really start with there. But before we talk about how much is enough, I guess we have to quantify enough for what, Edward?
Well, we have an answer to that question. It consists of seven basic goods, as we call them. So health, leisure, harmony with nature, friendship, personality and respect. These are our own terms, but we sort of spell out what they involve.
And in a sense, we often look at how well we are doing in terms of salary or how well an economy is doing in terms of GDP growth. And this is, in a sense, an attempt to say, well, yes, but it needs to be heading towards something, for
yes.
something.
It's to go underneath those figures and say, what do they mean in terms of human well-being and welfare? And if you probe them, you find that they mean much less than we think they do. For example, we believe that it improves people's well-being that for them to buy more and more, to spend more and more. we want people to spend less and less. So we shouldn't be here, perhaps.
Well, indeed, if you try to sell a book. I mean, because there is obviously a political side to what you're saying here, isn't it? It's in a sense, this is a political manifesto, isn't it?
Yeah, not a party political manifesto,
but in the
broad sense, yeah. Yes.
A moral manifesto, you could say.
Well, yes. Well, in fact, actually, I want to pick up on that issue of morality, because two of the key figures that are, you know, on your dust jacket saying what a wonderful book this is are religious figures. Rowan Williams, the former Archbishop of Canterbury, and also Giles Fraser, who was at St Paul's here in London. Do you feel that there is a morality, or there should be a morality towards capitalism that is perhaps missing at the moment?
Well, I think there's a moral standard and there are moral principles against which you can, you know, you can judge things from outside the logic of the system itself, which has its own goals and its own, the machine goes in a certain direction. Here's some people outside it saying, let's apply a different standard to it. And I think it's very important that that should happen. And I think it's very important that the churches should do it. It does not mean that the religious standard is the only outside standard. Religion is part of morality.
Our book got a very favourable perception from church people. I think they've slightly lost their way in recent decades, and the financial crisis gave them a sense of purpose again. This was, you know, something they could campaign about and get people's attention on.
Yeah, and it's the nemesis of greed, you might say.
Indeed. Let's go to that question. How much is enough? You talk in the book about, you know, when you were talking to friends, colleagues, whoever you came across, you would ask them that question, and often people would come up with some sort of monetary answer, like, well, I don't know, you know, 40 grand a year is that's probably enough to do this, that, and the other, and obviously it's far more than that. But do you think that there is a monetary answer to that question, how much is enough?
There probably is, but it's not going to be the same for every person. But the prior question is, what is a good life? Then within that category, what are my trade-offs between various things? So there's a lot of scope variation in how much people think is enough. Then there's also the question of where they are in their own lives, young, old, middle-aged, and so on. So you can't give a single figure. But what you can say is that on average, a rich country, which we are, countries like Britain, should actually, on average, work less than people do, because otherwise they're simply on a treadmill of consumption, which leads nowhere, finally. And so they've got to have some idea of what the purpose of money is and what the purpose of working is.
We were supposed to be working less, weren't we? I mean, you know, John Maynard Keynes said, well, by 2030, everyone will be working 15 hours a week because everything will be so much easier by then. It hasn't really worked out like that, has it?
We're working a bit less than when he wrote in 1930, down from 50 to 40 hours a week. But yes, nowhere near 15, and it doesn't look likely that we'll get there by 2030.
The paradox is that the very rich are often working much harder. And why is that? It's a question I don't think people have ever haven't given a very satisfactory answer to. Why, if you've already got 10 million or 50 million or 100 million, do you work 60, 70 hours a week? Why can't you actually relax, take it easy? Why are you still on this? So that's a paradox. With people at the bottom of the income scale, you can actually understand more easily why they may work long hours, because they haven't got enough. There's a very skewed income distribution in our country, after all.
And just on that, looking at those at the top, or certainly those that are sort of relatively comfortable and why they work the hours they do, I mean, is there actually an argument that people enjoy their jobs and actually get something out of it?
Sometimes, but I don't think that explains the very long hours in the financial sector. There, it's much more job
example,
insecurity
yourself,
and competition.
Do you enjoy what you do? And do you? I'm assuming you don't do 15 hours a week.
I do enjoy what I do, but I think I'm a bit unusual. I mean, and I didn't do it for money, certainly. I mean, I'd be a fool if I did. But there are not many people who get to write on whatever they want.
There's a range of jobs which obviously do afford quite a lot of job satisfaction, but I don't think that's true of most jobs. There's a lot of propaganda. For example, prêt-à-manger. I mean, they talk about passionate chefs creating for the customer. I don't think that's a very satisfying job. And I think, and when I talk to people there, they also say, well, you know, that's part of the cosmetics, the advertising for it. So I think a lot of people would like to work less than they do at the jobs they're doing. It's as simple as that. I think anything else is propaganda. When people are asked, would you prefer to work less? majorities generally say yes, even in America, which is regarded as the big workaholic country.
But how do we get to that situation where actually they want to work less and they can work less? Let's take Pret-a-Manger. Let's say if you're there and you're working, your hourly wage is, say, £7 an hour. Yeah. You're not in a position to be able to work less, are you?
Well, that's why we advocate a basic citizen's income in our book, which is an annual payment made to all citizens, regardless of whether they're in work or not, of maybe a few thousand a year at first. And that would just give them more flexibility.
That'd give them more flexibility. And then you have to look at the distribution of income and who's making profits and who isn't. Then you can also have quite a bit of work sharing thrown in, which would enable people to, it's advocated for hard times, but it could be part of a continuing scheme of evolution of work towards a more leisured life. I think distribution of income is very, very important. It's become much more unequal, so that you have many more dead-end, minimum wage, zero-hour contract jobs around, and everyone's thinking, look, we're doing brilliantly at keeping employment up because we're creating all these no-hope jobs.
But the first thing someone's going to say to you if you say, well, there should be a basic minimum income of, let's say, £5,000 to everyone, £5,000, let's say there's 40-odd million adults here in this country. You guys are better at maths than me, but that's a lot of money.
Yeah, and you wouldn't start it there. You'd build up. Actually, one of the good things that the last government did, it was Gordon Brown's baby bonds, which was a beginning of an attempt to give everyone a little pot.
This was, £1,000 given to every baby, essentially, at birth.
And then that built up into, not much, but by the time they were 18, they would get control of it. I think it was earmarked for certain uses. But the basic idea was good. It was independent of the labour market. It just gave people an extra avenue. And I think you can build on things like that.
I want to ask you a more general economic question. You're both Keynesians. This should have been a period for people like you, but it hasn't been, has it? I mean, we've just had George Osborne this week saying, my policy of austerity has worked. Don't worry, we've turned a corner. Everything's fine. So were you guys wrong?
I don't think we were wrong. First of all, you have to ask what's going to happen at the next election, which isn't clear whether they're... But secondly, studies have shown that under the policies of austerity, British gross domestic product is 3% lower than it would have been. OK, I mean, that is huge cost to the population. OK, they're not. When things are getting better, people always think they're more cheerful. How long is it going to get better? I don't know. All these forecasts are not worth the paper they're written on. But they do create feelings, and those feelings could change instantly if the next set of figures turn out to be disappointing.
There's an argument, though, that even if your economic argument is correct, that politically those that were opposed to austerity have lost that argument.
Not in the United States and not completely anywhere, because those who opposed to austerity did get a sop, which is known as quantitative easing. You see, they say fiscal austerity, yes, but money, print lots and lots of money, because they know that fiscal austerity isn't going to produce the growth.
How did you two, and Edward, perhaps you'll be best to answer this first, how did you find working together on this?
Very agreeable. We didn't have any major bust-ups, a few points of disagreement. So it was a very good experience for me.
Have you worked together before at all?
Not really. No. I think it would be fair to say that ever since Edward was small, we have talked a lot and talked about things that really interested us both. It wasn't the beginning of a completely new conversation. It was just the beginning of a new project that we hadn't done before. But some of the material had been germinating over years of conversation and reading and discussion.
How easy is it to tell him that he's wrong?
Well, I didn't have to tell him that often.
Of course, I'm assuming that there might have been an occasion.
We both read and commented on each other's drafts. And
I think we're both quite open. And I personally love criticism. I think the most important thing is to get anything you write or say taken seriously. I think it's very hard to get it taken seriously. If what you think is taken seriously, there will be criticism, because it means people will have engaged. It's when they don't engage, but just sort of have a headline of some kind, that you really feel your work's not being valued. And of course, Edward engaged. He was bound to. We were writing the book together, and I engaged with what he was saying. And so that sort of criticism is great. I mean, it is the making of any achievement.
And that was Steve talking to Robert and Edward Skidelsky a little earlier on.
We're going to be hearing from a filmmaker next who's focusing on the humble honeybee.
Join Monocle's editors every weekday at 8 a.m. for The View from Midori House. We'll be setting the day's agenda with special guests in the studio and from our bureaus around the world.
The opposition needs to identify the key message to deliver to their niche. And their niche is the 60% of the population who's voting for Korea right now.
We'll check in with our editors on the road, whether they're snowbound or sun-kissed. And of course, we'll still have the focus on music, media and the arts that you've come to expect. That's Midori House, every weekday at 8 a.m. London time.
There's a touch of gold rush optimism on Fogo Island, the remote outpost off the coast of Newfoundland. Monocle Films journeyed to this idyll lost in time to witness reinvention at work.
Just living in that tangle with the North Atlantic breeds a kind of acute awareness of the natural, and I think it just makes you kind of quick and quick to a solution. To a response. And so that, I mean, you could call that entrepreneurial, but the ingenuity is all here. So really what we hope to do with our projects is just to kind of be the electric eel in the pond that helps with the connections.
Microloans meet macro ambitions on Fogo Island in the film section of monocle.com.
Over the past 30 years, global numbers for bees buzzing around our gardens have been in decline. Last year, UK bee colony losses doubled. And this year, the EU voted to ban pesticides thought to be harmful to bees, an essential part of the world's ecosystem.
Markus Imhoff is a Swiss filmmaker whose new documentary, More Than Honey, looks at the plight of bees and also beekeepers the world over. Earlier, Monocle's Tom Edwards spoke to Markus on the line from Italy to hear why the film is creating such a buzz. Sorry about that.
Our business relies entirely upon pollination by bees.
We've got 4,000 hives here at $150 a hive. That's $600,000. To me, that's real money.
Even vegetarians depend on industrial animal husbandry.
We're capitalists. We want to grow. Total global domination.
Markus, thanks very much for joining us on Monocle 24. I wanted to just start by asking you about some of the story that you tell about bees in More Than Honey. It's really about a lot of the way that they interact together, and there are obvious comparisons with the way people interact and the way that bees interact. Do you think it's helpful to compare people and bees in that way, the way that they work together in their social groups?
Of course, you can't compare it completely, but the structure of communication and working together is very fascinating and could be a kind of example for democracy. Of course, we can't kill all the men in autumn because they wouldn't be useful in winter time. So you can't copy it everything of it. But the concept that everybody works for the benefit of the whole is a very interesting concept who could be useful for finding a solution for humans.
It's interesting. One of the contributors in the film in the United States, he talks about the way that people live, the way that people work, and he says it's not possible to shrink a lifestyle and to be happy. Do you think that that is true? And do you think that the experience of the bees reflects on that broader problem in terms of human society?
This concept of this industrial beekeeper, he has 15,000 hives and travels with them through the whole continent. this is a very neoliberal way of thinking, and that, you know, the Swiss director of the German bank once had as a program to grow every year 25%. So I don't know any tree in the world that can give this performance. So it's not an organic concept, that if everybody wants the total global domination, as he says as well, then it's a total war. If you compare the whole world with a swarm, we are part of a structure. Everybody has to contribute that it went well for everybody. I think the key reason why the bees are dying, and this is just an example why the world is going where it goes.
But the bees are in trouble now. A few years ago, they started dying. Not just our bees, they're dying all over the world.
I don't have time to take it personally. I know this hive didn't mean to die. I just got to move on.
Let me ask you, Marcus, there are these amazing scenes in the film where bees are being sort of prepared and dispatched and moved around. As you said, it's an industrial process, but there's also sequences where they're mailed out to be sold all around the world. What was your emotional response to those scenes in the movie as you put the film together? Did you find it difficult to watch? Did it conjure some conflicting emotions?
Yeah, of course, it was even difficult to shoot it, but if I would have criticized the people doing it, I wouldn't have been allowed to shoot it. So it was quite a difficult approach. But for me, it was very important that the point of view of the bees is more the center of the film, that the audience can be emotionally also involved with the bees. And it is like Charlie Chaplin in the industry in modern times, working in an unnatural way for a bigger concept. That's why I hope this kind of revenge, if you will call it, of the killer bees at the end, is one of the answers, that the bees are a kind of a rebellion of the bees. People are afraid of them, and they are the only ones who will survive.
There are amazing scenes in the film, as you say, towards the end, of these killer bees. They initially, the response from the public is quite outlandish, and they talk about swarms of killer bees sort of tracking people down. But it is an amazing story about their resilience, about how strong they are, and perhaps a lesson for the future. Was it important for you, as you structured the film, to have that part of the story at the end, to find something positive, to perhaps show a way that the bee can fight back in the future?
Yeah, for me it was important that there is also hope, even that this hope is not what we have expected. But nature will fight, and nature will survive, and nature will not care about humans. So this is a quite interesting lesson. The film is asking the audience, are we humans part of nature? If you compare the two attitudes towards nature and the bees between John Miller, the industrial beekeeper, and Fred Terry, the man who is working with the killer bees, and he lets them go. So it's like the two concepts of having or being.
It's a fascinating narrative that runs through the movie. I wanted to ask you, at the end of the film, there's also exploration of some experimental work in Australia, again looking at the African bee. You mentioned that it's almost like a Noah's Ark, and I believe some of your family are also involved. Tell us a little bit about that and why you wanted to include that in the film.
These are not African bees, they are just feral bees. It's a kind of mustangs. You know, in Australia there have not been any honeybees. They are brought in by the settlers. But some of them escaped and became feral and lived by themselves and have developed under stress of evolution and have got another genetic evolution than the domestic bees. So they are catching the drones of these bees to get the genetic information for breeding them to make them, the honeybees, stronger. They have very sophisticated technical possibilities to analyze the genes and the immune system of the bees, but they are the healthiest bees in the world there.
How would you characterize the relationship with bees? What is it about them that makes them so special? Is it the relationship with man, or is there something more fundamental? What's the thing that you find so endlessly fascinating about them?
I guess you can compare it to meat like in the Avatar movie, to meet the other species on the other planet, but they live between us, the bees. It's like a journey in another science fiction world. If you get in contact with them and you work with them, it's like making a journey to in another world. There is this famous Nobel Prize winning scientist, Frisch, who was discovering the waggled ants. You see these black and white pictures in the film. He said the bees are quite like a magic fountain. The more you take water out, the more it comes out. I've worked 5 years on this film, and now I'm traveling for a year with the film, and even now I learn almost every month something I didn't know. This symbiosis between plants and insects, man is just coming later to this cooperation between plants and insects.
That was Tom Edwards speaking to Marcus Imhoff a little earlier, and you can find out more about the film available on DVD in October by visiting morethanhoney.co.uk. Time now for a punning song, Andrew. What do you want to listen to? What do you hear? What do you think when you hear a thing about honey?
I'm normally quite good at these things, but
it could be anything. There's a lot of honeys.
A
taste of honey. We're going to have Andrew Just Like Honey by the Jesus and Mary Chain. Just Like Honey, Jesus and Mary Chain, and that's what we've got time for. We got a little bit sticky towards the end, but 219 shows down, we're still rocking it, aren't we, Andrew?
We're doing fine, I think.
Been at the end of a long hard week.
Yes.
I think it's both time now. We went out, we had our Sunday luncheons.
And we may have a little tipple as well.
We may have a little tipple. I'm kind of in the mood for one, I think. Okay. I think I've thoroughly deserved one. And I know you certainly have. All that signing. I know. Should we thank our cats behind the glass?
Well, one just vanished.
One of them vanished.
Tom Hall, the producer,
he's vanished.
He's already had enough.
We'll thank him. I don't know. We don't really need to, do we? Because look at him. He's just leering at us through the glass. He's kind of given up. It is a Sunday.
Don't forget, if you want your book signed, Rob's your man. He'll sign your book any time of day or night. Just give him a call.
Okay, I think it's probably time to leave it there. We will be back with you next week. Same time, same place, maybe the same people behind either side of the glass. For the time being, from me, Robert Pound.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
Thanks for tuning in.